Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network. We are honestly provocative talk radio for the Pacific Northwest, and we serve Idaho, Washington, and Oregon through 24 great radio stations. We've got a lot to talk about today, and a lot going on in the Pacific Northwest. I'm going to say the story about the young man, 18 years old, who decided that Seattle's slushy snow could actually turn into big-time dough for this young man from Coeur d'Alene. It is a fantastic story, and I'm going to suggest a little bit later on, it's the kind of story that suggests what is available if you're a young person who decides to get up off your duff and get out and actually do something. Now, this young man sounds like he's a very capable young man anyway, but can you imagine making a five-figure paycheck in less than a week by simply going out and doing the job that people need done? And he did it with the kind of resources that should be within the reach of almost anybody who's in their late teens or early 20s. But we'll get to that a bit later. Our Twitter poll today, and this is a very serious subject, because it has to do with lawmakers who commit acts of sexual harassment, or I think this is almost worse in some ways, they help cover up the sexual harassment committed by their colleagues and other staffers. These are lawmakers who should no longer be in public office, and I think the name at the top of that list is Senate President Peter Courtney of the Oregon Legislature. His office had its share of sexual harassment complaints. There were payoffs that were paid, and they were paid out of taxpayer dollars. There were people who were excused for the kinds of things that they apparently were up to. And that meant that the speakers, or the president of the Senate's office, was not exactly in a position to call anybody else out for that same kind of behavior, although some were called out. And yet, it sounds like now the Oregon legislature wants to bury this, and they literally have a bill. We'll talk about the particulars a bit later. But here's what it amounts to. Should we make sexual harassment complaints about lawmakers public, or should we keep them shrouded in secrecy? Now, I can understand protecting the young man or the young woman who makes an accusation of sexual harassment, says, I just went to my job to do my job, and I got a bunch of extra attention that was unwanted and illegal. If you make that kind of complaint, I think at some point, if you decide to take it to court and it becomes either a criminal matter or a civil matter, it's got to be made public. But the person who's accused, if that person is a state lawmaker or a high-ranking staffer for state lawmakers, should that stay secret from the public? I'd say no, it should not. The public ought to know what is going on, and they ought to know about the accusations as well as the final disposition of those cases. You can answer today's Twitter poll, and that's a very simple question. Should we make sexual harassment complaints about lawmakers public? You can find it at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. Also, LarsLarson.com, the website where everything is free except the challenge coins and the sale of those benefits veterans. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by The Pearl, the Black Pearl, a new and stunning event center now open with capacity for large and small groups, personal or corporate events with amazing views. It is a must-see. Black Pearl on thecolumbia.com. Now, in yesterday's Twitter poll, I asked you this. Should we let 16-year-olds vote in state and local elections? 2% of you said yes. And 98% of you joined me in a no vote on that question. It, too, is a piece of legislation now being considered. In fact, I've had more than a few people suggest that the example being set currently by the girl who calls herself the girl from the Bronx, U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, the one who sabotaged the Amazon deal that would have brought 25,000 new jobs to the New York and New Jersey area. Yeah, I think she's on the outs with her own party right now. Don't expect her to last in Congress. But she seems to be a good argument in favor of raising the voting age rather than lowering the voting age. But I wanted to bring up another issue, and this one might be near and dear to you. If you have children or grandchildren in public schools, let me ask you a question that is going to sound like a really stupid question. But let me make this admission first. When I was in high school And when I was in junior high, I did not skip school. I mean, not only did I feel guilty if I even considered the idea of skipping school, I actually liked school. I know you can call me sick and twisted, but I liked going to school. I liked learning things. I knew that there was plenty of time for other things outside of school. So I didn't skip school. Well, I do have one admission. I did skip school one day because I was 16 years old. I just turned 16, and I wanted to get the license that I had to get to be able to work at the radio job I'd been hired to when I was 16. So this is 44 years ago. I did skip school that one day so that I could jump in my truck and drive all the way into Portland and go to the federal building and sit down with a bunch of adults, most of them, you know, pocket protector slide rule kind of type guys, who were sitting there taking a test so I could get an FCC license that would allow me to sign the transmitter logs at KTIL, the original radio station I worked for way back in the day. And I needed to have that license, and there was no way to take the test any other way. They didn't give it on weekends because, of course, the federal government doesn't work on weekends unless you're in the military, and they didn't give it outside of school hours. So I skipped one day. As far as I can remember, that is the only day of school I've ever skipped. But there were days when I was on the road because I was going to speech and debate tournaments. Now, should I have been marked present in class by the school if I wasn't in school, but because I was going to a ball game or a swim meet or a speech and debate tournament? I would say to you, you should mark the kids present in class who are present in class. And if they're not present in class, even if it's for a very good reason, not because they're skipping school, but because they're off doing something else, some other extracurricular activity, should you mark them absent when they're not there? The current guidelines for the state of Oregon, at least, say if the kid isn't there, you mark him or her absent. But here's what they actually do. I just told you what the rules are. Guess what the folks who run the multi-billion dollar public education system do? They mark the kids present. And now the legislature wants to change the guy, Governor Brown wants to change the guidelines to make it the practice that if a kid is gone for one reason or another to a ball game, a swim meet, a debate tournament, student government, whatever it happens to be, just go ahead and mark them present. I think that's lying to the voters. I think it's lying to parents. It's lying to the taxpayers because the system guarantees that every single child will get 990 hours of instruction. Now, we have right now a huge problem with absenteeism. There is a gigantic portion of the student body, at least in the state of Oregon, where a huge number of kids miss more than 10% of all the school days in the year. And most of those misses are because of skipping school. But the state wants to improve the numbers and make the numbers look better. So they say if the kid is missing for a football game, a track meet, or whatever, we should still mark him present so we can show an improvement in the numbers, even though nothing has actually changed. I consider that just a very fancy way of lying, and I think it's an extraordinarily bad idea. Anyway, glad to get your phone calls and emails. We have a lot to talk about today, including whether or not Senate President Peter Courtney should step down at least from his leadership position in the Oregon State Senate because of the incidents that have happened within his office, because of staffers of his who were harassed and other staffers who are alleged to have harassed staffers, and about public payoffs that were made to buy people's silence, and those payoffs made with public sector dollars, meaning your tax dollars. Should Peter Courtney at least step down from his leadership position and possibly even step down from his Senate seat? Nobody else is raising the question, so I'm going to raise the question. We'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Gay rights have been well established in the United States. No matter what you think of that subject, they are well established. Protections in the law for employment, housing, and even marriage. Not so much on the rest of our planet. In fact, nearly half the countries on Earth, homosexuality is a crime, including 8 countries where it's literally a death penalty offense. So you'd think that American gay rights groups would welcome the Trump administration's brand new plan announced this week to push countries to decriminalize. Well, you forget the liberal mantra these days is orange man bad, orange man bad. One of Donald Trump's top diplomats, Ambassador to Germany Richard Grenell, heads up the effort. Grenell, by the way, is the highest-ranking gay official in the administration. Kind of wrecks the narrative about Trump, doesn't it? Out magazine, which has been championing gay rights for the past 25 years, has now condemned Trump's global gay rights effort. And they brought their condemnation just hours after the Trump administration announced it as some kind of, and I kid you not, racist trick. They claim it's really aimed at the Muslims. Well, in case you haven't noticed, if you want to find places where gay people are stoned to death, locked up in prison, or thrown off the top of a roof, the Muslim countries are a great place to start that search. Maybe those who believe in gay rights could just put your liberal politics aside for a moment and tell the orange man thanks. From our Facebook page, Jack Christensen writes in, "Hey, buddy, so here's my comments on the push you talked about yesterday to let 16-year-olds vote. I think the only reason for doing this is to guarantee a Democrat vote forever, along with the liberal brainwashing at our public schools. The Republicans will then never win any election, and that is scary. Thanks, Lars." Signed, Jack.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I'm going to give the Daily Grill today to all the cowardly lawmakers who refuse to demand that the Oregon Senate President Peter Courtney step down from his leadership job, at least, and perhaps from his Senate seat altogether. The news broke yesterday that two former legislative interns had filed a civil lawsuit against Senate President Peter Courtney and former State Senator Jeff Cruz. Well, Cruz is a bit of old news at this point. He was resign from his office in February a year ago after several women said that he had committed sexual harassment against them. The women who filed the lawsuit were law students when they interned in Cruz's office. They alleged that Cruz's behavior was well known in the Capitol. Not a single member of the legislative leadership, human resource management, or a single senator can claim ignorance to that history, says the lawsuit. The longevity and visibility of Cruz's conduct and the large number of accusers point to the knowledge and reckless disregard of the defendants who failed to take action to prevent the plaintiffs from experiencing harassment by Cruz. Now, one of those people is Senate President Peter Courtney, and I think the best thing for him to do would be to step down. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by High Caliber Millwrights, building the Northwest with a reputation you can trust. This one comes from Michael McClafferty. "Lars, the spandex mafia is destroying Vancouver neighborhoods and the business district. Lars, I am your perfect caller. I'm a lifelong progressive liberal who now needs your help. The city of Vancouver is in cahoots with local bicycle groups, secretly pushing through some actions to remove 900 off-street parking spaces from downtown historic neighborhoods and a nearby business district. I'm the ideal caller for you because you can gleefully puncture me for being a lifelong Democrat being ruined by fellow progressives. I live in a historic neighborhood due for parking removal, and I work in Uptown Village, which will be devastated by the parking loss for customers. The designers of the bike lanes lied to the local neighborhood groups and business associations and said that only one of the one street of bike lanes, they have now added five more streets secretly." Signed, Michael McClafferty. Mr. McClafferty, I don't care which side of the political aisle you're from, you're right on that issue, and you're right, the spandex mafia is doing a job on us. Now, to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS, that's 866-439-5277. Well, why not start with the man who sent me the email who happened to call in? Michael, you're that liberal progressive who sent me the note?
Yes, I am, sir. First-time caller. I feel like I'm in weird territory right now, but I need your help.
That's okay. You're perfectly welcome to come and appeal for help because you're really appealing not to me but to everybody who listens to this program, many conservatives, but a lot of your kind as well, progressives, and that's okay. We like having them on as well. In fact, some of your progressive friends like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are God's gift to talk radio, so welcome to the program.
Thank you for clumping me all together with them. You're welcome, sir. For me, I think we have a chance of talking this out because, unlike Portland, you know, in Vancouver, our town is just small enough that we know the mayor and the council members by name. So I feel like this is, I feel like I'm under siege by literally my own friend.
That's sad, isn't it? So what do you want to tell them about why we should keep accommodating the 95%+ of the people who transport themselves in fossil fueled vehicles against the 4% that ride on transit and less than 1% who get around on two wheels?
I want to tell them that I support a bike route, and what they told us initially was one road. As it has grown and they've misrepresented it in their literature, their photos, their online, it is more than that. And they've tried to sneak this through, and I am just personally just beside myself about what to do other than to plead for maybe your listeners to reach out to the mayor and the council members.
I think at some point when those folks have made their positions clear, and the mayor's been on this program, she seems to be a nice lady, although I think she's a bit misguided about light rail, and she plans to ram light rail down your throat as well, even though many people have voted against it. And the last time that the voters were allowed to vote on it, they said no, and the public official said, we know better, we're going to do it anyway. So you might have a tough time persuading her. What you might tell her is you're not going to be mayor anymore if you stick to this position. That's the only thing that I've found works with politicians.
Lars, you're so right. Your parents loved you so much, they named you twice, and I love that about your name, Lars Larson. But I will say, I'm trying to reach out to them. I'm trying to speak to them. And I feel like they have really, really brought about something underhanded, and they've really misrepresented it to the neighborhood association and to the local business district.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to work with you. We're going to see if we can get the mayor on. We'll talk to her about it and say, have you misled people? And are you telling them the truth today? You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Your calls at 866-439-5277. And I want to tell you something. I'm joined now by Aaron Mesh, who is the news editor at Willamette Week, and you can find them at WWeek.com. There are a couple of different things I want to tackle with Aaron about some big stories that they've told. But I want to ask you a question first, Aaron. This is the second time today that I've called for the current leader of the Oregon Senate, Peter Courtney, has stepped down. And I didn't do that lightly. I did it earlier for the same kind of reason, because it appears that he not only ignored sexual harassment that was happening within the legislature when he was the leader of the Senate, but it also appears that he ignored it in his own office and sometimes by members of his own staff, and that he used taxpayer dollars to pay off to buy the silence of at least one victim. And so today we've got this lawsuit filed by interns who said they were the subject of this unwanted attention and that Courtney knew about it. And that's why he's named in the lawsuit. Can you tell me this in a liberal, progressive, blue Northwest? Why isn't we aren't hearing the hashtag Me Too types calling for Peter Courtney to step down? Aaron, you are strangely... Aaron, are you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now, but you're awfully muffled.
No, I am on my cell phone.
Okay, well, that's better.
So can you hear me now, right?
This one's iffy. Let's figure out... I don't know what's going on with your cell phone, but you're so muffled it's going to be tough for people to understand what you're saying.
Anybody here?
Nope. Okay. You're going to have to take that Obama phone down and actually buy a real, you know, phone from a capitalist somewhere. So,
well, I am really sorry about that. That's all I've got today.
That's
not reporting.
Okay. Well, gosh, I can't do it, Aaron, because I wish they'd warned me, but this is horribly muffled and it's not working. So we'll have to try it another day, but I will tell you briefly about the two big stories we're going to talk about. One has to do with the fact that even while Peter Courtney and others are being sued over this alleged sexual harassment, the legislature is considering a bill, and here's the way it's described. It would establish a legal privilege of confidentiality, both for those who report they've been harassed, but also to the people who are accused of doing the harassment. In effect, the bill would make the legislature different from every other workplace. employees who face sexual harassment in every other workplace have the option to file a complaint with the state agency, the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Complaints filed with Boley are public records, but complaints to the Legislative Equity Office would not be. In other words, the bill would protect lawmakers from a repeat of the public embarrassment they suffered when then-Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian released his damning findings back in January. So, who supports it? The Capital Culture Committee, led by Ginny Burdick and Jennifer Williamson, both liberal Democrats. In other words, they want to be treated differently than every other workplace, and that simply doesn't make sense for me. The second story concerned why prosecutors failed to take a member of the Patriot Prayer Group, a guy who goes by the name of Tiny Tozzi, that he apparently assaulted someone, told the police that he assaulted somebody, but for whatever reason, the prosecutors decided not to make a case. Now, they say they needed the police to gather more evidence, and they say the police didn't come through. Well, here's one of the problems. If you know the name of the alleged assaulter and the assaultee, and you know what time it happened and where it happened and what is alleged to have happened, and the person who allegedly assaulted somebody has told the police, yes, I did assault somebody, then how much more do you need? Any case, you can find the stories at WWeek.com. Let me get to your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And I want to hear from maybe a liberal, like the gentleman who called me earlier this hour, who said he was a liberal progressive. I want to hear, what do you think when liberal progressives like Ginny Burdick and Jennifer Williamson say, we should have a law that if you are the victim of sexual harassment in any other workplace, when you report it, your name is known and the person you're accusing is known. But if it happens at the legislature, it should all happen in secret. Anybody agree with that kind of nonsense? Now to your calls. Let's go to Jason. Hey, Jason, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Well, I was want to talk about the absenteeism on schools as far as the children,
yeah,
how they mark them.
Yeah, where they're marking them present, even though they are actually off on a field trip or a school-sponsored extracurricular activity, they're marking them present.
Correct. And I believe it has to do with funding. If they're not at school, they don't get all the funding for each child.
I think you're right.
I believe it worked. I didn't know. Yeah.
Well, so, I know there's a count day that they usually have, and I think it usually falls in October, where they count all the classrooms, because they don't necessarily, they count absence, they count attendance every day. But throughout the year, you're supposed to get 990 hours of instruction. And the more kids they have that are marked out because they're on a field trip, or they're on a football game or a basketball game or a track meet or a speech and debate tournament, if they have to mark them absent because they are absent and the rules say they have to mark them absent, I don't know that it necessarily affects the funding directly, but it certainly affects whether or not that student is marked down as getting the full 990 hours of instruction during the year that state law guarantees.
I agree. I just know that they went as far as actually sending them home, anticipating a huge snowstorm, sending them home with packets for them to do on the time they were thinking they were going to be off, and actually going as far as saying that they were going to call them, and if they didn't answer their phone, they were going to mark them tardy. So it's just pretty wild the length they're going to make sure they get their tardiness or their marks being there or not.
You know what's sad, Jason, is an awful lot of the school systems in America and here in the Northwest treat kids like they're cattle, and the school administrators are ranchers. And you're worried about your cattle, not because you care so much about the cattle, but because you care about whether or not the dollars attached to those cattle are going to find their way to the pockets of the, not necessarily personally, but to the treasury, so that they can be spent on school issues. And I just don't think that should be their first priority, is making sure the dollars come in, whether the kids actually get educated or not. Let me go to Brett in Corvallis. Hey, Brett, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call today, Lars.
Sure.
I enjoy listening to your program. I'm listening. Go ahead.
You're listening? You called in to talk to me. What's on your mind? That's why I said, what's on your mind?
Oh, Well, I was just listening, and regarding the attendance and truancy in the entire state of Oregon, and Governor Kate Brown wants to sharpen the saw, so to speak, on how attendance is recorded when people who have extracurricular activities where they could potentially earn a letter during the winter season, such as swimming and or basketball, for instance.
Brett, you're restating what I've already said. What's your point today? We need you to get to your point.
I practice paraphrasing and active listening. So my message...
Well, don't practice on me, please.
Excuse me?
Don't practice on me. Get to your point, sir.
Oh, well, my message is basically I favor Governor Kate Brown's initiative to get involved in better attendance taking.
Well, she's not getting involved in better attendance taking. She's getting involved in lying. She wants to mark a kid as present in class when he or she is not present in class. How is that better attendance taking?
Well, basically, high schools recognize that it's important to use human energy to pursue something that is worthwhile.
Pulling my leg? Because this is BS. And I think I kind of think that you're trying to pull my leg because you're just they utilize human energy. There is one job the schools have: educate the kids. It says in state law, every child has a right to be in the school. If they want to be educated at home, if they want to do their own education through online courses, they can do that. But they are guaranteed a seat in class. And state law says they're supposed to get just shy of 1,000 hours of instruction. If some of those hours are hours when the kid isn't sitting in the classroom, how does that accomplish the job that is outlined in law?
Well, once again, I mean, if we're talking about an age group in which is different than high school, for instance, of course, we already realize that's
we're talking about mostly high school. There aren't a lot of elementary school field trips or football games. I don't know that there are fourth grade football games. Maybe there are, but I'm guessing they don't get on a bus and drive across the state. So, Brett, I'm going to try one more time. Is it telling the people who pay the bill, the taxpayers, the truth if you tell them this kid was in class when he or she was not in class?
Well, I think it is true when we're talking about a high school person who was busy with an extracurricular activity.
That's considered instruction. Sitting on a bus and driving to the other side of the state, you would mark down as instruction. Does that work where you work for a living, if you work for a living?
Yes, indeed. That does indeed work.
It does. What do you do for a living?
Well, sometimes I do landscape maintenance.
Okay, so if you tell the homeowner, I'm going to work in your yard for 3 days, and one of those 3 days, the homeowner looks through the window and doesn't see Brett out in the yard cutting the grass or trimming the bushes or planting anything or digging anything up, and you tell them, well, I was off on an extracurricular activity, but you should assume that I was still working in your yard, even though you didn't see me in your yard. Would that work with your client?
With my client, yes, because they have good eyesight, so they can see actually what has been accomplished.
Okay, I just think Brett is trying to jerk my chain, which he did to a certain extent. Does your boss, let me ask you, does your boss say, go ahead, if you're on an extracurricular activity of some kind, just report in. Just punch that time card and tell us you were there, even when you weren't. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, that last caller, that's one for the record books. He says, I just tell my clients I'm there, even if I'm not. Gary writes in, and I won't say where Gary works, but he works at a good, responsible company. And he says, Lars, in my working world, we terminate employees who claim to be on the job but are found somewhere else. It's called theft. Keep up the good work. Let's go to Bellingham, listening on KGMI. And naysayer Rick is on the line. Hey, Rick, thanks for listening, and welcome to the program. I love naysayers, so tell me what you and I disagree about.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I listen to you a lot, agree with most of the stuff you say, but I think that your frustration with the school district's treatment of the absence is a little bit misplaced.
Okay, and here's tell me why.
Because In my opinion, the root issue lies with the windbags in Olympia and Salem, who think they know best as far as, you know, how many days of school students should have instruction and that sort of thing. A better plan would be let the school districts make those kinds of calls. There's a difference between, in my mind, the difference between counting a student absent because they're at a sports event, and I agree, that should not be counted as an absence. Or it should be counted as an absence, excuse me. But a student who is away at a field trip doing an academically related learning experience, why is that not, isn't there root cause, is there root?
I would be with you on that. If it's tied, you know, we took science field trips to places like nuclear power plants and things like that. I get that there is some educational value. But I think you're mistaken if you think that when they wrote the law and specified the number of hours of instruction, that they were doing it in a vacuum. I have a feeling that over the years, those laws, and I can't prove this, I don't have it right in front of me, but when they said at the legislature, we should have a law that says how many hours of instruction every kid gets. And they didn't just pick a number out of the air. They held hearings, they talked to educators, and the educators gave them their opinion. How many hours should it be? Should it be, I mean, would you call high school okay if you gave 25 hours of instruction in a year? I think even a layperson could say, well, that's crazy. You can't learn high school in 25 hours. On the other hand, should we make it like a full-time job? 2,000 hours a year, Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. Well, that wouldn't work either. So they picked the number, and they guaranteed in law the kid would get it. If they're allowed to then say, well, let's just, even if a kid is on a bus 10 days of the year on his way to football games or track meets or speech and debate tournaments or whatever, we're going to mark him as being present, and we can tell the voters and the public, yeah, we're meeting the commitment. We're providing 990 hours of instruction to every student in the state when they aren't.
Lars, I think counting hours is where the error is. Who was the Einstein who thought that simply having a kid sitting in a chair equates to education?
No, they said 990 hours of instruction. I mean, this would be like,
where do you think that came from?
Well, it probably came from somebody saying we can't just say we've provided education where there's a building and a bunch of books and a teacher, and you say, well, how often the kids are there?
Sure they can. They can. It's called tests. It's called your graduation rate. It's called your success as far as students.
Yeah, but you could graduate 100% if you said, hey, kids, show up for 15 minutes on September the 1st. We'll mark you all in. We'll put you in a room full of books. You aren't guaranteed an hour of instruction or 10 hours or 100 hours. You'll get whatever you get. And at the end of 4 years, we'll call it good and hand you a diploma. You could have 100% graduation rate if you did it that way. So instead, they decided we've got to actually say the kids will get almost 1,000 hours of instruction per year. And if you do that for 4 years, you get a diploma. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our daily Twitter poll. Find it at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. You can also go to our website and find it there as well. You know, I have to admit, I tell you that I will always admit to you if I have a dog in the fight. So I live in a home today, so because I have housing, I've got a bias. In the past, I have lived, a long time ago, in rental housing. And at one point, I don't anymore, but at one point, I even owned some rental housing. So I've had the experience of being a landlord on a very, very small scale. And so those are my dogs in the fight. When I hear that lawmakers are talking about passing limits on whether or not the landlord can raise the rent or not. I know that to some liberal progressives, this sounds like a brilliant idea. Why, we're going to make housing inexpensive. It's one of the biggest costs people pay, so we'll just cap the cost of it. The first thing I think is, why don't they cap gasoline at 50 cents a gallon? Why don't they cap steak at 10 cents a pound? Because you understand that if you ever did that, there would be no gasoline for sale and there'd be no steak for sale. And I think the same kind of thing could happen even before you get to the point where it becomes an impossible price like that, you know, 50 cents for gas and 10 cents for steak, that with housing, if you decide to cap rental increases instead of letting the marketplace decide based on 100 different factors of supply and demand and that sort of, and cost. that if you do that, it's going to be disastrous, not just for the landlords, but especially for the people who want a place to rent so they have a place to live. I've invited Doug Bibby on, who's president of the National Multifamily Housing Council. Doug, welcome to the program, and tell me what you think of these latest efforts to try to impose controls on what landlords can do.
Well, thanks for having me, and I totally agree with you. This is a step in the wrong direction for Oregon, and this is after Portland took one step in the wrong direction by rescinding the ban on inclusionary zoning and making it harder for developers to develop housing. So, yeah, price controls always fail. The market sets the prices, and when you come in and try to set arbitrary limits, you're ending up with the wrong kind of consequences from that. It always fails, and yet they're going again in that direction with SB 608.
And it sounds as though this thing may actually pass. It seems to have the support to pass. And if it does, how's the marketplace going to respond to that? How are landlords who currently own rental housing going to respond? And how are the folks who build rental housing or build housing that could be used as rental housing, how are they going to respond to this?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, rent control has a chilling effect on the housing market. Typically, the only people who benefit are those who are in rent-controlled properties, and they're happy as clams. They never move, and therefore the housing stock is not improved. The affordability always worsens, and the people who pay the price are the people at the lower end of the spectrum, the poorer renters, who have no places to go when supply begins to dry up. So, it's treating the symptoms of a disease and not the disease. And that's what bugs me the most, I guess.
Well, it bugs me, too, because when I look at both the situation that Seattle and the state of Washington has, because they're similar, they may be not as bad, but they have limitations on land. They have limitations on construction. They'll load on extra factors like saying, well, you're going to build a 50-unit apartment building. You have to set aside 5 or 10 units and rent them at below market costs, effectively taxing the rest of your tenants to pay for the cost of that housing, which is, I think, the kind of tax the liberals like the best. That is the kind where you can't see it happening, but you know it is. But I also think about quality of life, because I think I've lived in really old buildings before, but buildings that have been remodeled. And I'm wondering, what happens in a rent control environment if you say, well, first of all, you can't evict somebody without cause. So nobody can come in and buy an old building and say, we ought to, we'll give everybody plenty of notice. They'll move out. We're going to go in and redo the entire building. And it'll be this great old building where all the pipes are fixed, all the electric's fixed. There's new floors. There's new everything. And people will say, look at this great apartment. It's 100 years old, but it looks like $1 million because it's been all fixed up. I know that dislocates people temporarily and sometimes permanently, but it also creates the kind of housing people brag on. They say, look at this. It's a great old building, and it was all fixed up. I don't know of a way for a landlord to do that in a rent control environment where you say, you can't go to the person and say, we're going to, the first time there's an empty apartment, we're going to refurb the whole thing. We can't do the whole building because we can't empty the building because we can't tell everybody to move out for no reason. We're limited on that. And after we come in and completely redo your unit, we're not going to be able to raise the rents enough to make it pencil out. So we just won't do it. We'll fix everything that breaks. But other than that, slap a coat of paint on it now and then. But other than that, you're kind of stuck with what you got, aren't you?
That's exactly right. I mean, I couldn't state that any better than you just did. It just chills the ability to invest. It makes owners want to get rid of their properties. It makes investors stay away from the market. Developers looking to come into the market are going to say, wait a minute, I can't have my rents meet market. And therefore all my other costs, my insurance, property taxes, all the maintenance required, are going up, much faster. And therefore I can't invest in that property. So it takes that over time, it just takes that property out of the stock.
And the other thing that would help me, Doug, is, would you mind going through some of the nuts and bolts of rentals? Because I haven't owned a rental in a couple of decades. But I think they think the landlord is this person down there with a twisted mustache. And, he's saying, ha, 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 I'll get my renters. Most of the landlords I know are mom and pops, the ones I've known over the years. And they love having a great looking property. and they don't make a mint. They make a good living. They make a good return on their investment, but they work hard for it. And I think the tenants all think, well, the landlord's just getting rich on my back. And I want you to talk, if you can, if there's a way to generalize, of what the kind of returns are that people are usually getting.
Well, you're right. I mean, the vast majority of the units that are owned in about 20 million in this. Did you get that?
Yeah, 20 million. Yeah.
That are owned in this country are owned by smaller owners, mom and pops and so on. You'd also be stunned to find out how many members of Congress, senators and members of the House of Representatives own rental property.
Oh, I was going to bring up Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Have you seen what she's doing?
Yeah, yes.
She advocates for what they call, what is it, inclusive housing, where you build a fancy new building and then you set aside 8 or 10 or 10% for poor people. She deliberately moved into an apartment building that's very fancy, the Navy Yards apartment complex or something along those lines, that's very fancy and doesn't provide anything for poor people. So she advocates for it, but she doesn't live what she advocates.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. But to your point, the vast majority of ownership is smaller owners, and rent control kills them because this is their, in some cases, it's their livelihood, and they are not able to invest in the properties that they own if they're faced with that kind of stricture. So the economics are solid. It's real estate's a good investment. Multifamily is a good investment. We did a study about a year ago that compared returns in all the different sectors of real estate, and multifamily has the best returns over time on a risk-adjusted basis. So it's a very sound investment, but the vast majority are smaller people. They're your neighbors. They're people. They're your cousins. They're your uncles, your aunts who own these properties.
And they have to put a lot of their time into taking care of them. And if you crunch their profit margins down by saying, oh, sure, your costs went up, but you can't raise the rent enough to make up for it, then at some point, if they get crunched down far enough, they have to economize wherever they can. They say, well, I was planning to recarpet and repaint, but I'm just going to do the bare minimum because you've cut me off of the knees, so I don't have the extra money to do it.
Yeah, and I think this is the problem, Lars, is that policymakers don't look themselves in the mirror. You know, they're part of the problem with this thing in terms of the restrictions that are enforced at the local level with, zoning and land use and all of these things, the entitlement processes themselves. And then, the letting the NIMBYs control the environment, you're not allowed to put apartments here, there, or anywhere. And so Oregon is about, over the last 15 years, we did a study. While the population's grown about 10% in Oregon, over those same 15 years, Oregon's about 155,000 housing units under demand. So, they're part of the problem, and they've got to be part of the solution here. And yet they're pointing the finger at the landlord, saying, it's your fault. You're raising rents. Now, if you don't have enough units and you've got demand surging, those rents just have to go up.
Absolutely. Doug, I appreciate your insights, and we'll look forward to talking to you. I kind of have resigned myself to the idea that the lawmakers are probably going to pass this, and they'll go around and brag that they've fixed the whole problem. They don't have any more supply, but they're going to put a cap on the price. And the bad effects, they'll probably come in the years and the decades ahead. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Lars. I appreciate it.
You bet. That's Doug Bibby, who's president of the National Multifamily Housing Council. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and your emails. And as you know, naysayers go to the head of the line in this program at 866-439-5277. Emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails. I've been a bit remiss on that, but you've got my point of view on housing. I think the biggest problem with housing is not the cost of labor. It's not the cost of materials. It's not even the cost of land. It is the government. The government that says to you, whether it's Seattle or Portland or the Tri-Cities or Eugene or some other place, first of all, they slap on all these land use restrictions. That limits the supply of land. It does to land what the Arabs used to do to oil. You artificially limit supply and you jack the price out of sight. And then you say, oh, by the way, you need a whole bunch of government paperwork before you're allowed to even start turning over dirt to build a house or an apartment complex. Oh, and we'll have requirements for you on how much you have to pay your workers. We'll have other rules and regulations about when you can build and how you can build and the cost of building. And then all the folks at City Hall and the state legislature start wringing their hands about, oh, we don't know why housing costs so much. Because of you. It's because of you. Let's go to Naysayer Paul. Hey, Paul, we love the naysayers. Welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about today?
Lars, I called about the school attendance issue that you brought up today, and
okay.
I got a couple points I want to give.
I want to bring everybody else up to speed on this. Right now, the rules say that if a student is not in school to go to a track meet or an extracurricular activity of any kind, the rules say you're supposed to mark that student absent. What the schools have apparently been doing is not following the rules and marking the student present when they're really at a football game or a track meet or a debate tournament or something else. So now the Governor Brown administration wants to you're doing a great job, Brownie, by the way. Brown administration wants to change the rules so the school can say the kids are sitting in the classroom when they are, in fact, not sitting in the classroom. In other words, they want to legalize lying, which, coming from Kate Brown, shouldn't surprise anyone. Do you think that's a good idea?
Partially. Okay. I love you. I love your show. I hate being on the other side on this one. But
that's all right.
I give three examples that you talked about was like sports. You talked about debate. You talked about, you know, like field trips. So in sports, we're teaching the kids that going to that game only represents a very small part of what that child has been invested into the instruction in physical fitness, teamwork, drive, communication, all those great attributes.
They're all good things, but should we mark them down as meeting the criteria for 990 hours of instruction per year? In other words, if you got a kid who signed up for every sport he or she could sign up for, swimming, football, basketball, baseball, track, soccer, the commie sport, all of that stuff. If you sign them all up, they could continuously be going to sporting events and only rarely, maybe show up once every couple of weeks in the classroom, and you could say, wow, they're getting their 990 hours. Do you think that would be honest?
Well, I don't think it works quite that way, because there's a certain amount of grade point average a kid has to keep up in his academic work. And
the coach will take care of that. He'll go down and I had a coach.
I know that happens in college.
In high school, too. Believe me, there was this one. I don't even know if this lady's still around, but my freshman English teacher, Miss Dorsey, and she was a nice gal. And one day she came back into the classroom and she was weeping. I mean, she was crying her eyes out, and all of us are sitting there thinking, what the heck is going on? And she was just bawling. I'd never seen anybody cry like that before. Turns out that she had given one of her students a D, and he happened to be on the football game, good team, and the coach needed him that coming Friday night. And he had read her the riot act, and he, of course, had been there quite a while, and she'd only been there a year or two, and so he just took her apart verbally for having given one of his players a grade that was the grade the kid deserved, but not the grade that was going to have him on the field on Friday night. So I guess let's get back to the central issue, though. Should we expect the schools to tell us the truth? If you're promising
the truth.
Go ahead.
Absolutely, they should tell the truth. But I think that we could make some compromise there to give them credit, a percentage of credit for the amount of hours that they're putting in,
But most of their practice they're doing after school hours, not inside of school hours. So the time you're going to give them credit for is going to be time they're sitting on a bus on a Friday, not often on a Saturday, but more often on a Friday, on their way to an away game, and then they're playing the game outside of school hours. And they're out of the classroom for that time. You're going to give them that's going to count as credit toward their 990 hours, even though they sat on a bus. That's all they did.
Well, change the regulation. Instruction is different than in a classroom. And I believe there's a lot of instruction that happens. For instance, if somebody goes to OMSI and that's not in the classroom.
Well, now you're changing the subject.
Field trip.
Would you imagine that most of these absences are for sporting events?
I don't know what the volume you're talking about here. And it's just the way I grew up, and when I went football, basketball, track, for the number of hours that I put in learning the things that I learned by being on a team.
And that's a good thing to learn. Unfortunately, it doesn't often translate into a real-world job. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday night. I'm glad to take your phone calls from all over the Pacific Northwest. The Radio Northwest Network serves Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk radio. Now, there are some firearms issues that I want to talk about because of bills. In this case, we're going to talk about the bills before the Oregon legislature, although there is one thing I want to mention, that apparently in the Washington legislature, there is a bill that is moving right now, meaning it's not stuck in a committee somewhere, that would actually revoke or repeal Initiative 1639 passed by the voters that imposed a whole bunch of foolish new rules that aren't going to stop any violent crimes. They're not going to stop the criminals, but they may turn some honest, law-abiding citizens into criminals. But I want to mention one other thing before Dominic Aiello is on the phone. So, Dominic, welcome to the program. But there's something I've got to mention because this story just broke. I follow Donald Trump's Twitter feed. And did you hear the story about the young lady who left America about 5 years ago as a 19-year-old to join ISIS and murder Americans? And the one who tweeted out about, you know, go out and make the blood of Americans run and get a truck and drive over them and hurt them and kill them. You familiar with that story?
I believe I do recall that story, yes.
Yeah, her name is Hoda Muthana. And over the weekend, the story broke in some of the British newspapers that she is now a very sad member, former member, I guess, of ISIS, having joined the Islamic State for a short 4 or 5 years and watching her two husbands get killed as terrorists, which is what they tend to do, is get killed, that she's now decided she's very, very sorry that she left the United States and she'd like to come home. Donald Trump just tweeted out minutes ago that he has ordered the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, to, under no circumstances, allow Hoda Muthana back into the United States. And he says Mike Pompeo agrees. And I think I do, too, because I said so the other night. I said, you go overseas to murder Americans and you encourage people here to commit murder on American soil using trucks or guns or whatever you have available to you. And then you turn around and say, now that ISIS has been largely wiped out by the United States and its allies, now you want to come home? The heck with you. Stay in Syria is my view on that.
It makes sense to me.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about some of these bills that are before the Oregon legislature. Dominic Aiello is the president of the Oregon Outdoor Council, and they are one of the groups out there fighting against some of these ridiculous new rules that are being proposed, including a ban on buying more than 20 bullets a month, a ban on wildlife contests, and new gun storage requirements, which are not going to be followed by any of the criminals, but they will turn some law-abiding citizens perhaps into criminals. Tell me what your group is doing about these and what you've got planned.
That's right. You know, and in all the years that I've been monitoring the Oregon legislature, this has got to be the worst for sportsmen and just gun-loving Oregonians that I've ever seen. You know, the SB 501, which I know you've talked about before, but to talk about it in a little bit different aspect than maybe mentioned previously, is this, you know, this has implications to potentially all but eliminate waterfowl hunting. I mean, what duck hunter, what goose hunter is going to go out and pursue duck or geese when they can only purchase 20 rounds in a 30-day period? I mean, I can easily, you know, spend that on two bad duck days. And so that is one major concern in that bill, as well as, you know, most duck shotguns, whether it be a semi-auto or a pump, have the capability of holding more than 5 rounds. Granted, when we duck hunt, they have what's called a plug inside the magazine chamber there that only allows a total of 3 rounds of the gun.
But right.
Those typically can be removed, which would then make that gun illegal under this bill.
Yeah. So hold on, Diamond. Just so people understand, the bill, this SB 501, literally says if the gun is capable of holding more than 5 rounds, and it does not say in a detachable magazine. It just says if the gun holds or is capable of holding more than 5 rounds, it is an illegal firearm if SB 501 passes and is signed by Kate Brown. So people should understand this will make most of the pistols and most of the rifles illegal and shotguns illegal in this state, right?
Correct. Correct. Absolutely correct. And another aspect that may not be considered is Pittman-Robertson is how largely conservation is funded in this country. So what that means is generations ago, sportsmen got together and self-imposed a 13% excise tax on firearms, ammunition, and hunting equipment. And that money goes to our state agency to fund ODFW. It funds wildlife habitat purchases, such as the Lower Deschutes. We received ODFW $15.5 million through that tax in 2016. If we limit how many rounds people can purchase in a 30-day period, that will devastate that conservation money.
Which means that even if you don't like hunters and hunting, that the money that goes to wildlife conservation efforts through the state's agencies like ODFW, that it's going to limit the amount of money they have, and it's not likely to be made up by a legislature that is currently pretty close to broke, as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly correct. You know, and then the other bill that we're really concerned about is Senate Bill 723. We've rallied our membership. We have flooded the committee that is in charge of that bill. And what that bill would do is we eliminate wildlife contests. And what that has the potential implications of is to limit everything from fishing derbies to coyote derbies. Now, currently, it does have language in it that excludes fishing as under the definition of wildlife. But that's not to say that couldn't change at any given point. So it's a very dangerous bill because how many, charity groups have a fishing derby every year to raise money for local schools, for veterans causes? It's a very dangerous language.
Well, and let me tell you something, Dominic. I don't know if you've heard the story in the last couple of days, but we're seeing more and more coyotes that are coming into populated areas. And, you know, first of all, they can carry diseases. Secondly, yep, they can take away your household pets. Third, they can scare the daylights out of people, although usually coyotes will take off and run. But if they're in a populated area, I've had them trot up my driveway as well. And believe me, that'll spook somebody. If you've got a small child, like my granddaughter is visiting and a coyote trots up the driveway, you say that's not something that you view, you know, without a little bit of alarm. And you say, well, just get rid of them. The problem is, even if you have coyote derbies, I've got a friend who works for Federal Fish and Wildlife, and his job is to remove problem animals, you know, whether it's a problem bear, a wolf, or whatever. And Kenny Mitchell will tell me they'll go out in a particular area of the state and they'll shoot 600 or 700 coyotes. And I'll ask him, well, how much of a dent did you make in the population? He said, maybe a third. And I said, how long will it take that population to recover? He said, next year they'll be back. And they populate like rats or bunnies or whatever rapidly reproducing animal you've got out there that's obnoxious. And they so having these derbies where people go out and compete for either the number of coyotes they can get or the size and weight and all the rest of that is not a big deal. It is not going to wipe out the coyotes, not by any stretch of the imagination. So then the only objection you could have to it, and I know some people will, is I don't like the idea that you're hunting an animal, even a varmint animal, for sport. Well, okay, you can have your own philosophical objection, then don't go out and do it. Don't take part in it, but don't tell everybody else they can't do it either, because there are certainly things that Democrats and liberals do that I find obnoxious that are legal. And so, leave us alone, I guess, is what we're asking. Please leave us alone.
You know, and that's an excellent point. Everybody should, you know, we should be able to disagree and not feel that we have to tell somebody else how to live their life. But it's not all bad news this legislative session. On the 29th, on the House Ag and Natural Resource Committee, there is going to be a hearing on House Bill 2795, which would implement a pilot program as a result of that the unfortunate hiker that was killed by a mountain lion last year, to a pilot program to allow counties to look at a pursuit season for mountain lions, whether that be non-lethal or lethal. So that there is some positive coming out of this session, too.
Well, if we could get dog... Is it time to go back for and ask for dog hunting? Because I made the case to my audience, Dominic, dog hunting was outlawed in, I think it was 94, so we've now had 25 years go by. We've seen the effect. The official number is 6,500 coyotes, or, sorry, cougar, which is about three times the number that were present at the time they voted the ban in. So you got three times as many cougar. They take up three times as much space because the males tend to be territorial, and they'll mark out their area, usually about 100 square miles. And if you triple the population, they're going to occupy triple the land mass. And that is why cougar are pushing in on people, not what you usually hear from the nitwits on television. Who say, well, you know, we're invading their space. Human beings exactly. live on about 3.5% of the land mass of Oregon and Washington. The wildlife has the other 96.5%. And the amount of time it'll take us to go from, say, 3.5% to maybe 5% might be the next 100 years. We are not pushing into their territory. That is it's a lie. And every time you hear it on television, you should call your local TV station newsroom and tell them, stop lying. Because it's, you know, the numbers do not back up what they're saying. But still in all, you've got all these cougar out there, and the only way to effectively hunt them is dogs, and that's been made illegal.
Correct.
In fact, when the state has to go out and take out a problem cougar, they use dogs. So it's another example where the state says, we want different rules for the state than we have for the citizens. And I don't think we should ever really be in a position where the government has more rules than the average citizen does. Do you have a rally coming up for any of this, or to get people out to have a show of force?
What I recommend everyone do is go to our website or our Facebook page, OregonOutdoorCouncil.org, or on Facebook, Oregon Outdoor Council. Sign up for alerts. We really need people to rally. When bills come up for hearings, we need them to flood the committee members with emails opposing the bills and support sportsmen of Oregon.
And do it sensibly and do it politely. Make phone calls, send emails. If you can, send text messages, whatever works. Dominic, keep up the great work at the Oregon Outdoor Council, and thanks for the time today.
Thanks, Lars.
You bet. Coming back, I'll get to your phone calls and emails, and let me ask you this question. To graduate from college, should you have to prove that you are literate when it comes to civics, meaning at least you have some rough idea of what the U.S. Constitution says? We'll be back in a moment, 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and your emails. I made that suggestion about civics to graduate from college. Frankly, I'd put the requirement in for high school as well. I think you ought to have a certain amount of civic literacy to understand a bit about how the government works and what our relationship is to our government. I find so many people, even adults, who do not understand the constitutional guarantees, where your rights come from, what the relationship is between the state and a city and a county and its citizens. And it's sad because it actually hurts people and it benefits the government. Anyway, the suggestion is made by the current president of Purdue University, former Republican Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, who made the proposal that his faculty come up with a civic literacy test to implement as a graduation requirement. Daniel says the purpose of the test would be to ensure that Purdue graduates have a fundamental knowledge of America and its government. I think that having a test versus having no test will certainly result in an increase in knowledge. We would like to be able to certify that in addition to all the other positive accomplishments at Purdue, you're leaving this with this fundamental understanding. I think it would be becoming of our institution, and I think it'd be a worthy contribution to our individual students. I wish a school board member or two in the Northwest would take that idea and take it to the local school board and say, shouldn't every kid who leaves high school leave with some understanding of how the government works and what the relationship is? Let's go to Michelle in Gig Harbor. Hey, Michelle, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind? And thanks for listening on KVI.
Hi, Lars. You were talking about the absentees of kids going being considered absent if they're going to a sporting event or a whatever.
Right.
It's the adults that make these schedules. As a coach, I'm a girls volleyball coach. We rarely get out of school early. We rarely miss school unless they're going into the state run
Okay.
So, I mean, how do you hinder the kids when it's the adults at making the decisions to take those kids for a sporting event?
Because it doesn't matter who's making the decision. Understand this. The way I look at it from the outside, you're inside education, I'm outside. The state law in Oregon and Washington are very similar. In Oregon, it says every student shall get 990 hours of instruction per year. But then, right now, the current practice is that when a student is missing because they're on their way to a track meet or a swim meet or a basketball game or a football game or a debate tournament or some other extracurricular activity, including a certain number of field trips, although I have a feeling that athletics probably explains more of the absences, they mark them down as present, even though the rules say they're not supposed to. So now Kate Brown says, why don't we just change the rules so that we always mark down an absent student as being present in class so we can count that as having met the goal? Well, Michelle, as a coach, since you're a coach, right? What if you told your students, what sport do you coach, by the way?
Volleyball.
Okay. I used to be a swimmer in junior high. So you tell your girls in volleyball, I want you to go out and do 5 hours of physical training a week. Well, you know, girls start doing it. And one day, somebody's dad says, you got to go do this for the family instead. And he takes her away for two of those 5 hours. Does she get to mark down, well, I intended to do practice? Or would you say, no, you missed practice that day because you didn't actually do it? What I'm saying is for academics, if you take the kid out of the classroom, you can't lie to the public and everybody else and say that kid was actually in the classroom, even though he was on a bus. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. As I told you, the president tweeted out just a moment ago, just literally within the last hour or so, that he has had a conversation with Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, and Pompeo agrees. The woman, Hoda Muthana, who left the United States about 5 years ago, she's an American citizen, she said, I'm going overseas, and she joined ISIS. And she then, on social media, encouraged the murder of Americans. And I read the quote, I can bring it back up again if you like, but she was encouraging people back in America who are also fellow jihadis to get a truck and drive over people and to murder people in public places. Well, see, things didn't work out so well for her. Her first husband, while she was a member of ISIS, got killed because terrorists often get killed. And then she married another terrorist, and then he got killed. And now she finds herself with ISIS, which is no longer the kind of force it was 4 or 5 years ago, and she would like to come home and have everything be forgiven. And unfortunately, that's not the way it's going to work. The president says he talked it over with Pompeo and they both agree she does not come back to the United States. And the only alternative I would hope would be that if she says, I want to come back to the United States, fine. The minute you get off the airplane, you're going to be put in custody. You're going to be charged with giving material support to terrorism, which is a federal felony crime in America. You're going to be put on trial and you're going to be held in custody. And I would hope that they would hold her in custody with no bail because she sounds dangerous to me. And for the protection of the community, the entire country, she ought to be held in custody until her trial and then tried. Apparently, you cannot take her citizenship away, but you can certainly take her liberty away and you can lock her up in prison for a good long time. And maybe you can send a message to anybody else who might be inspired to become a jihadi. And you know the Pacific Northwest has had its share of jihadis. We've had people who've tried to set up terrorist training camps in Northwest states. We had Mohammed. I talked to you about him a couple of weeks ago. He's the guy who about 10 years ago tried to pull off the bombing of a Christmas tree lighting. Now, the mainstream media didn't make much of the fact that it was a Christmas tree lighting, but I think there was some significance to a Muslim jihadi trying to blow up a square filled with thousands of people waiting for the lighting of a Christmas tree. He did not succeed. He is now sitting in prison for a good long time. So when you have people like that in your country, I think it's important to send them a message now and then. If you decide to take the role of a terrorist to aid and abet terrorism, then you're either going to go to jail or you're not going to come back to this country. Our Twitter poll today goes this way. Should we make sexual harassment complaints about lawmakers public? The lawmakers, they haven't done this yet in Olympia, but in Salem, the state lawmakers are talking about changing the law. Here's the way it is right now. If you work for a private employer and you believe that you've been the subject of sexual harassment, you file a complaint with the state agency and both your name and the name of the person or persons you accuse are public. The state lawmakers want to have a special rule just for state lawmakers where their names and the names of their accusers are kept secret. Now, we've seen this happen in Olympia before, where the state legislature says everybody has to follow the public records law except us. And we know the U.S. Congress does this all the time. They'll pass OSHA regs and say, but they don't apply to us. They'll pass equal employment opportunity laws and they say, but they don't apply to the Congress. They pass all kinds of things. And, of course, we've had a Congress that just recently has gone through a scandal where members of its staff and even members of the Congress have taken part in sexual harassment, mostly of young women, mostly by aging males. And then they got away with it because they were allowed to use the taxpayers' money to buy the silence of those mostly women who were the victims of that harassment. And they tried to keep it secret. And now they want to keep it secret at the state level. And by the way, I think it's worth noting that the leadership, because of numbers of the legislature right now in Oregon that is trying to keep sexual harassment secret, is made up predominantly of Democrats who hold supermajorities. They hold the governor's office. They hold every statewide office except Secretary of State, God bless him, Dennis Richardson. So they're in charge. In other words, the political party you would most expect to say we're the champions of hashtag Me Too are saying, but when it comes to Me Too, if you're actually accusing a member of the legislature, we have to keep that secret. And I think that's pretty ugly. By the way, I did want to mention one thing on sort of a lighter note, but one where I'm a little bit both dismayed and encouraged. Because I know that every generation has said, well, you know, that younger generation doesn't know how to work. I know we've heard that a lot. But there is something different going on in America today where an awful lot of millennials and younger to late teenagers do not want to get a driver's license, do not want to move out of mom and dad's house when they graduate high school, do not really want to go get a job, are not terribly industrious. And then you see a story like this one. It involves a young man. I was trying to get a hold of him today. His name is David Holston. So if David Holston is listening, David, call in. I'll give you the VIP number if you like. David Holston is a young man from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. So he lives just a little bit to the east of Spokane. And this young man, at age 18, already has his own business. And what he does in Coeur d'Alene is he plows snow. He has a Dodge pickup truck. And he has a snowplow blade on the front, and he gets paid about $100 an hour to plow snow when there's snow in Coeur d'Alene. By the way, the number is 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Well, anyway, here's what happens. David Holston says, one of his friends said, hey, it's going to snow about a foot in Seattle. Now, I've done the drive from Spokane to Seattle multiple times. I know what it is. It's a bit of a drive, and especially if you're going over Snoqualmie Pass, it can be a little tricky in the wintertime. He drives all the way to Seattle, and he starts plowing people's snow. He just offers his services up for a fee, and he says he was charging $500 an hour, and he was back at home, he's getting $100 an hour. And he said, and then demand grew so much, he had been charging as much as $7.50 an hour. This young man, David Holston, has racked up $50,000 that he earned honestly. Because you can imagine somebody who's got a big pile of snow in the parking lot at their business, at an apartment building or whatever, says, tell me what it's going to cost, get it done. He goes out and does in 1 week $50,000 worth of business. And his costs are, well, I'm sure he has to have insurance on his truck. He's got the cost of the blade, probably repairs from time to time, a lot of diesel that would get burned up that way. But hey, you make hay while the sun shines and you plow while the snow falls would be maybe the way to put it. He said his phone was vibrating the whole time. He's taking phone calls from people saying, come here, come there, plow this Walgreens parking lot. And I'll tell you, I understand when you hear $500 an hour or $750 an hour. I'll tell you what, when it's snowing like that and you realize that your customers are not going to be able to get to your business, or they're not going to be able to plow their car, or they're going to crunch their car into somebody else's car because your parking lot is full of snow, and this kid will clear it out for a price, you will pay the price. And I thought, how industrious of a young man not only to have his own business at the age of 18, but say, if it's going to snow a lot in Seattle, I'm going to Seattle, and I'm going to be plowing. And he does $50,000 business in 1 week, and then here's part of the best part. He's giving 10% of what he earned to his church. Congratulations to you, David. I hope I get a chance to talk to you one of these days. And David, if you want to call in, it's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, so the minute I said that Hoda Muthana was a U.S. citizen, somebody said, no, she's not a citizen. Well, that's where the heart of this issue really comes down. Her attorneys claim she is a citizen of the United States. The Trump administration says she is not. And it is true that most people born in the United States are considered birthright citizens, although we've had big, long discussions about whether or not that's being properly applied. Under the Immigration and Nationality Act, a person born in the U.S. to a foreign diplomatic officer is not subject to U.S. law and is not automatically considered a citizen. Muthana left her home in Alabama to join ISIS in 2014. She claims she escaped ISIS and was captured by Kurdish forces. She now says she deeply regrets her decision to join ISIS and understands she may face prison time in the United States. She is believed to be the only American woman inside the Al-Hawl refugee camp. But it gets more complicated because Britain said on Tuesday it was revoking the citizenship of another woman who's in a similar situation. But the Trump administration says she is not a citizen. Her attorneys say that she is. And here's a quote from her attorneys. Hassan Shibley is the attorney for Hoda Muthana. The Trump administration continues its attempts to wrongfully strip citizens of their citizenship. Hoda Muthana had a valid U.S. passport and is a citizen. She was born in Hackensack, New Jersey in October 1994, months after her father stopped being a diplomat. So the Trump administration is saying you're not a citizen. Mike Pompeo is saying as of 3 hours ago, she is not a citizen, because ordinarily children who are born to diplomats in this country are not considered citizens of the United States. You could see how that'd be problematic if the Chinese ambassador, let's say, came to the United States. His wife was pregnant. She gave birth on U.S. soil. And we said, hey, the child of the Chinese ambassador is now an American citizen. So we exclude diplomatic officers. She's saying that her father stopped being a diplomat. She was born a couple of months later. Therefore, she is a citizen. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says that Hoda Muthana is not a citizen and that she has no legal basis to claim American citizenship. Here's the quote. Ms. Hoda Muthana is not a U.S. citizen and will not be admitted to the United States. She does not have a legal basis. She has no valid U.S. passport. She has no right to a passport nor any visa to travel to the United States. So it sounds like this one's going to be fought out in court. Let's go to Craig, who's a naysayer. Hey, Craig, welcome to the Lars Larson Show and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Oh, it's about the sports issue you have with them getting credit for days, you know, spent going to games and whatnot.
Yeah, and by the way, just so you know, the current rule is you do not get credit for extracurricular activities, and somebody was nice enough to send me the Oregon administrative rules that explain all of that. What Kate Brown is saying is let's change the rules so that you'll get credit for being in instructional hours at a time when you are not even in the classroom. What do you think of that?
Those activities are giving them life skills. You said it didn't apply to a work situation. Who doesn't want somebody who knows how to be part of a team, who understands how to take instruction, who understands the value of hard work?
No, I want all of that.
Who understands how to defeat? Yes, you do. So why wouldn't they get credit
because
for
that's
it?
Not, because that's not, because the rules, do you mind if I read you the rules? Instructional time, and this is the way it's defined in the law. Instructional time means time which students are engaged in regularly scheduled instruction, learning activities, or learning assignments designed to meet the common curriculum goals, and they are working under the direction and supervision of a licensed and registered teacher, CT instructor, licensed practitioner, or educational assistant. Number C, instructional time shall not include time that a student spends passing between classes, at recess, in non-academic assemblies, or non-academic field trips, participating in optional school programs, or in study periods or advisory periods where attendance is not required and no instructional assistance is provided. Now, while they're traveling to an away meet, like an away football game, they're sitting on a bus and they're being transported to a school somewhere else, an hour away, 5 hours away, a day away. It depends on the trip. Should that count as...
Yes.
Yeah, but hold on. They're supervising. Craig, they're supervising. They're sitting in a seat on a bus. Now, you're going to tell me that you want to count...
They're
what?
Aren't most coaches also teachers?
They are, but they're... Well, some coaches are... Hold up. Let me ask you a question. They're sitting in a bus. What are they learning by sitting in that bus seat for 2 hours on their way to a football game? What's the instruction?
They're going to have to at least mind. And
the fact that they behave well is...
They work hard. No, let me finish my point. They
make a point.
Work hard to get to where... They work hard.
Yeah, but all that work took place on... Hold on. All that work took...
A couple hours on a bus?
Craig, Craig, hold on. All of that work, the practice they did, is generally done outside of school hours as they're practicing on the football field or on the basketball court or on the tennis court or wherever they're practicing their sport. They're not. Now, that instruction is happening, but it's happening outside of school hours when they're sitting on a bus or some other vehicle that's taking them to a meet. What is the instruction that they're getting?
Work. They work to get...
They're sitting on a bus.
The value of hard work.
No, but that's all the hard work... Craig, hold up. I'll put you on hold if I have to. While all the hard work they did on the football field, all that practice was done back at their school. They are now on game day. They leave on Friday morning. They get on a bus. They're not doing that hard work anymore. They're sitting on a bus. All the hard work you're talking about...
Over a couple hours on a bus.
No, I'm talking about times where it may take a day. It may take an entire day out of school to be transported to somewhere to play a Friday night football game at an away school. Why would you give them classroom instruction time for sitting on a bus for 4 or 5 hours on their way to a ball game?
They earned being there.
Yeah, but the earning happened on the practice field after school back at their own school.
No, it's whether they earned it or not. I mean, they earned it, whether it was...
Well, you really want kids to come out of school dumb, don't you?
No, I want them with life skills.
Well, and the life skill is sitting on a bus and not... Your life skill is sitting on a bus and not misbehaving.
No,
that's the life skill?
And it's not participating in a sport and sitting in
the sport participation. The sport participation takes place almost exclusively outside of school hours, and it is not counted as instructional time, right?
I just don't see where these kids work hard and what's their bonus at the
end?
They
get to play football. They may get a college scholarship. They may get a chance to play in the NFL. There are lots of rewards. They get a Letterman jacket. They get accolades. So there are lots of rewards. But you want to say them, it will count while you're sitting on a bus on the way to a ball game. It'll count for the same as sitting in a classroom, listening to a teacher teach something that you're not particularly interested in. That's a wish for kids who will come out of school knowing nothing. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I know we've been having a lively conversation, and here's the genesis of it. The governor of Oregon in this case, although I'd expect the same kind of nonsense from Jay Inslee, although he's running for president, so maybe he's focused on bigger stuff. But Kate Brown, the governor of Oregon, wants to change the rules to say that when a student is on a non-academic field trip or is on their way to a sporting event of some kind, debate tournament, whatever, that all that time can be counted if it has to come out of the school day. And you know how this worked. A lot of times a football team, if they're going to an away game when I was going to Tillamook High School, they would show up they'd show up for school in the morning, and at 10 o'clock in the morning, they'd leave. They'd get on a bus, they'd be transported to whatever away game they were going to, and then they'd play the game that evening. She wants to count that as instructional time. And as Larry writes in, Lars, aha, Comrade Kate wants to include marching and anti-conservative demonstrations as instructional time, or maybe marching in support of Antifa with Mayor Wheeler. Now, let me add another element, and this comes from one of my colleagues, Dane Vauder, who said, look, some of these kids are going to end up feeling very or acting very, very entitled. Now, you've never met a late teen who's just come into your workplace who acts entitled. That never happens. But he's saying if you tell these kids you're supposed to spend 900 hours in actual instruction, not time between classes, not lunchtime, not time when you're going to non-academic assemblies. So you don't get, if the school brings in and they would from time to time at our high school bring in music or they'd bring in other things, and you say that's not instructional time. They want to count that as instructional time. So you're chipping away at the amount of time that the teacher and the student are actually exchanging some kind of information. And you want to start counting a bunch of other things so that the bureaucrats can say, why, we supply all of our students with 900 or so hours per year of instruction. Remember, as a comparison point, what we consider full-time in this country is 40 hours a week, 2,000 hours a year. What we consider full-time instruction in public school is less than half of that, just over 900 hours per year. So if you say, well, we have to have American kids ready to compete with the kids from all over the world, and they're going to work effectively half-time, and then the bureaucrats will get a chance to count time sitting on a bus on the way to a track meet as instructional time, all you're doing is cheating the kids to make the bureaucrats look good. And when that kid says, gosh, I went to high school, I've got this diploma right here to show that I graduated, and they say, but you missed an awful lot of the instruction at school because you were going to track meets or football games or baseball games or basketball games, or you were playing tennis or you were playing golf or you're going to debate tournaments like I did. And you're going to say, does that graduation certificate actually mean the same if you missed a lot of school while you were traveling to athletic events? And you say, well, on paper it does. Yeah, on paper doesn't count in the real world. What counts in the real world is actually knowing things. Let's go to Steve, who's a naysayer in Washington. Hey, Steve, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
So I rarely disagree with you. I never, actually. But so in this situation, Lars, I kind of do. And I'm not gonna walk over you like your last caller did. We can have a debate about this.
Okay.
So I tell my kids, school is like your job, and you work your butt off, and so, like, these kids that go to school and are academic and also the school athletes as well, they're working their butt off to get a scholarship, and they're getting their A's, and, you know, these kids that really, really want that. So if they're on their transcripts, that's one thing that the absences that these colleges look at. So the difference between getting in, I wasn't a good student, but, you know, I got B's and C's and, you know, not A's, but these school athletes that are looking to get into that next college, that next level college, these guys shouldn't be punished, I feel, for going and representing their school. And
well, we're not talking about punishing them. Maybe you missed something, but we're not talking about punishing them. What we're talking about is, in the same way, Steve, you probably work a job, right?
Correct.
If you tell your boss, why, I'll show up and I'll work my tail off for 10 hours a day. Your boss says, that's great. So you show up and you spend the first half hour you're there eating breakfast. And then you spend another half an hour on the phone paying bills or talking to your girlfriend or wife. And then at lunch, you say, boss, I got to drive my truck down and I got to drop it off at the dealership to get my truck worked on. I'm going to be gone for maybe 90 minutes, but I'll be back. I'll grab lunch while I'm on the way. And at the end of the day, you've actually turned in 7 hours of work. When it comes time to walk in and ask the boss for a raise and say, I promised you 10 hours a day. He said, yeah, you were around for 10 hours a day, but you were actually working for 7. And you say, well, no, but I was here for 10 hours. Does that work in the real world?
No, not in the real world, and I agree with you there. That those people that do that shouldn't get rewarded.
Well, on top of that, if you tell a client of yours, if you work in a job like the landscaper guy who called me earlier, and you say, I'm going to come out and you do 6 hours work at your house, and you send him a bill for 6 hours, and he says, I saw you actually working 4 hours. I'm not paying for six. That's the real world. Now, you tell me, well, these kids are working hard because they want to get a scholarship. Well, is the point of the scholarship to get somebody to pay for college, which is not a bad thing to do? But if you don't learn anything in high school and you arrive at college not prepared to do college academics, there is a chance, like buying a lottery ticket, that you'll end up in the NFL or the NBA or MLB, you know, or that you'll be a professional golfer. But that is like buying a lottery ticket. It's going to be one in 400,000, one in a million. And the rest of those kids should get something. If the point of working for a college scholarship is just to say, yeah, I went to the U of O and I played football. What'd you learn? Well, didn't learn a whole heck of a lot because, number one, I wasn't ready for college when I arrived there, which is true of too many kids. One quarter of all the people who show up at state universities in America today are not qualified to do college-level work at the freshman level. But, why? Because they spent all the time. So you're saying they got to get that great performance on the football field so they can win a scholarship. What for, other than that rare shot at the NBA or the NFL, if they're not even ready to do, they're not going to finish high school knowing what they ought to know because they didn't get the instruction that they were guaranteed by state law to get, and then they qualified for a scholarship to arrive at college not able to even do beginning college work. So what's the point of all that?
Well, those guys, those kids that are out to get those scholarships aren't going to be the ones that get a 2.3. It's some of them are.
Remember when I told you about my high school English teacher who got screamed and yelled at by the coach because she gave a D to one of his athletes? And the kid, I can tell you, deserved the D. All of us in the class thought that kid is the dumbest kid in class and he doesn't turn in his assignments. But the coach was angry because the D was going to, I think under the rules at the time, was going to keep him off the field on Friday night. And to the coach, being on the field Friday night was the number one thing. To Ms. Dorsey, my teacher, understanding English was the skill she was trying to get across, but she was told the school's football team was more important than whether or not she honestly graded the kid. So she was bullied into giving him the C because the C was the bare minimum that would put him on the football field. Do you think bare C's and a college scholarship are going to add up to much in the way of anything beyond football?
No, not at all.
But so we're lying to the kid, right? Get the scholarship so you can go to college. You won't be able to understand anything they're doing at college because you didn't really do high school, but you'll have a free ride. You'll stay in the dorms. You're going to walk around in a Letterman jacket. You'll look cool. A lot of girls will want to hang out with you. And then when you're all done, they may find a way to fake you through and give you a U of O, you know, or UW or Wazoo certificate that says you attended. But this is why I care about this, because I think when you say we need to deliver 900 instructional hours, and the reason they wrote that complicated set of rules was to say you don't get to count passing time as hours. And you think about all the time kids spend in the hallway. Over the course of a year, it probably adds up to a couple of hundred hours. If they could count that as instructional time, would that be legitimate?
Well, no, not in that situation.
Well, they wrote that into the rules. They literally said you can't count passing time. Now, you might say, well, passing time is 5 minutes between your morning classes, 15 minutes at lunch, another 5 minutes between your afternoon classes. But add that up for 100 or 170 days, it adds up to tens of hours. And if you said, well, I was educated because I walked around the halls a lot. Well, good for you, but what did you get out of it? Well, I learned where the bathroom was, I learned where the lunchroom was, and I figured out where all my classes were. Well, good for you. That sounds like a work skill.
And I don't doubt that Kate Brown will probably try to do that.
She is trying to do it right now. And I think she wants to lie to us.
These school athletes, if it's school-related, you're representing the school.
Yeah, representing. Yeah. But what is the kid getting? See, I see that promise of 900 hours as a promise we voters and citizens are making to the kids. We promise that you are entitled to 900 hours of instruction. If you allow the system that's providing that instruction to cheat, and say, well, it really was 900 hours. They were here. They weren't actually learning anything, but they were here. You're cheating that kid. Now, to the kid at high school level, he may think, I didn't really want to sit and listen about algebra anyway. I wasn't really that fascinated by history anyway. The problem is when they get out in the real world and their potential bosses say, yeah, this kid isn't very bright, doesn't seem to have learned much in high school. Unless you're in that NBA, MLB, or NFL, you're screwed. And you may be screwed for life. Well, I got a college scholarship. Yeah, and you couldn't do freshman level work when you showed up there. So when we faked that one through, you got the sheepskin on the wall, but it doesn't really mean anything. You're cheating the kids, and the change in the rules is designed not to benefit the kids. It's designed to lie to the public and say, we're actually educating the kids for 900 hours a year, but we're really not. But if you believe the lie and we believe the lie and the kid believes the lie because he's not that excited about school anyway, then it won't matter till he goes out and tries to find a job, at which point he may find out his paycheck is smaller and his prospects are thinner. Now, is that where we want to go?
No, but like I said, you need to reward those kids that are working their butts off. They're getting the 4.0.
How about this? Can I suggest a reward? Number one, you get to play a game that costs literally millions of dollars to provide the facilities and the coaches and the equipment and everything else. No matter which one it is, there's a lot that goes into it. You get that, and you usually get it for very little, nowhere near the real cost. Okay. Second, you get a public school education. I don't think this is impressed on kids very often. K through 12 right now in the state of Oregon and the state of Washington, state of Idaho, is $15,000 a year times 12 years. $180,000 worth of education, and you don't have to pay one thin dime to get it. And you say, oh no, we're already giving the kid almost $200,000 in education, plus a sports experience that in the private sector would cost you thousands and thousands of dollars, and you don't have to pay anything for it. And you're telling me, and we've got to give them a reward beyond that. Maybe we need to impress on them, you're getting $180,000 worth of education, and it's the only time in your life that somebody isn't going to demand payment for the bill at the end of that education, because all of us already pay it up front. I want them to take advantage of that. I want them to use it. And you say, I need to give them a reward beyond the $180,000 worth of education?
But these kids aren't the ones that are taking advantage of the system. My point is the ones that are working their butt off, getting the 4.0, going to sports.
I get that.
And these kids are...
Tell you something. What is the almost certain prospect for almost every high school athlete as far as whether it's going to turn into a job for them? It's almost zero, isn't it?
It's low, yeah.
So,
if you're saying
we take the dumb kids, we convince them sports is the possible lottery ticket, and in the meantime, ignore your education, who gets cheated in that picture?
Well, not ignore your education.
That's what they're doing. They're saying while you're riding the bus to the football game, you can count that as being in math class. Back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, I mentioned the man I was calling the snowplow kid, David Holston, and I was kind of hoping that he would call in, but I was admiring the fact that at 18, he owns a vehicle, a big pickup truck. It's got a snowplow blade on the front. He makes $100 an hour for plowing snow back at home in Coeur d'Alene. And when he heard it was going to be snowing in Seattle, he said, I'm going to go there. Managed to make between $500 and $750 an hour for getting the snow plowed. Dan, you had a couple of thoughts on our snowplow hero. What do you say?
Yes, sir, and thank you, Mr. Larson. What a pleasure to hear a story like that. I'll tell you what, it brings me back to when I was a kid and 16 years old and had a pickup truck, a 55 Willys Jeep, and put
truck
in driveways and sidewalks, and... you know what? Get his name, Lars, and could be the next president.
Well, somebody who's got it that organized at age 18 is clearly going to go some places. And I'll bet your only regret is you didn't hang on to that 55 Willys, right?
You're absolutely right, kind sir.
My father-in-law, Mark Van Dyne, is in the process of rebuilding a mid-50s Willys Jeep right now. And I think he wishes he had one that didn't need as much in the way of repairs as his does, but he's getting it put back together. Imagine if you'd hung on to that Willys 55 Willie's pickup truck back in the day with the snowplow on the front and just parked it in a barn somewhere. Imagine what you could get for it these days. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.